And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post Podcast, where we are 1 week away from the merciful end of the regular season, and I no longer have to scan Chicago Bulls box scores and think to myself, who in the hell are any of these players, except for Robin Lopez, who has become Hakeem Olajuwon, apparently. And to join me to talk many, many things, one of my favorite guests, one of the people's favorite guests from 538, Chris Herring. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. How are you, man?
I'm hanging in. We're almost there.
Oh, well, it feels like we've almost been there for 4 or 5 weeks at this point, just this last month of the season.
It's garbage.
It's bad.
Oh, you know, no, okay. I don't want to get into it. So it's garbage, and it is. Like, half the games are garbage. Yeah. Half the games are like, you just can't even, it would be a better use of your time to stare at the wall, drooling, than to watch, like, Bulls Suns tonight.
Yeah. Unless you're getting a 50-point performance from Booker, and even then,
I feel like
there are parts of those that aren't fun for me to watch either, when it's just like intentional fouling to either help him get to 50 or 60 or to stop him from getting there, which just feels kind of cartoonish to me after a while. But yeah, aside from that, the Suns games have been a little tough to watch. Definitely the Bulls games have been a little bit tough to watch as their whole roster is decimated. And then you also have like the contingent of people that are asking, like, well, are these guys really hurt, or are they just trying to tank all of a sudden when you've got people with blood clots with the Lakers and, you know, players that are having irregular heartbeats in the Bulls? It's like, it all just kind of feels worthless a little bit.
I feel like I need to debate Ben Golliver from the Washington Post on Devin Booker. I just feel like the population of people who think Devin Booker is good is dwindling, and I am among that. I think he's Devin still, Booker is really good.
He's still really, really young.
And people think he's a losing player now.
I think you put in something, was it one of your 10 things columns, where you said basically you have to see him in a situation where he at least has a chance of winning before you can just kind of write him off forever as far as someone that's not going to try on defense.
Offensively, that dude can do special stuff. The team has been trying to lose on purpose for essentially the entirety of his career. Mm-hmm. How do you think a player – you think Devin Booker is incentivized to try on defense at all by everything the Phoenix Suns have done? Goats are taking shits in the GM's office, and the team is tanking on purpose, and Devin Booker is supposed to be out there like, I got to get my footwork going tonight. I got to get – like, I got to be on peak stopper form. Now, you would like that. There are players who would do that, and you would admire them and be like, that's really wonderful that guy is giving his all for his crappy team.
There's a reason that nobody has ever done that at his age. You know, the stuff that he's doing with these 50 and these 60-point games consecutively, winning team, losing team. Does it look great that they lose every time he does that? No, but
he's also plus in a lot of those games.
Yeah.
If you look, which again, you don't want to read too much into it, but like, if they lose by 12 and Devin Booker's plus 3 in his 41 minutes, you're like,
that tells you
what
a lot.
In the hell happened in those other 7 minutes?
Yeah.
Like, how bad was it? Did they score any baskets? Did they hit the rim?
I mean, and has been better distributing the ball this year too. I mean, there have been improvements he's made outside of just scoring it. So I don't know. I definitely wouldn't say he's somehow not a worthwhile player. I don't know that anybody has made that argument, but the idea that we're, you know, I feel like at this point now, certain guys I've watched, Oladipo is one of them, you got to give them a couple years and sometimes really a change of environment to really see what they're going to be or what they're really capable of. Because sometimes it's just, there are too many things obscuring whether or not they actually could be more valuable than they are.
Give me all the Devin Booker stock that people are selling. Give it all to me. I'll buy all of it. And that is the last thing that will be said about the Phoenix Suns. On this podcast,
as we talk about the worthless stuff
until
at the, end of the
lottery. So before I trash the season, I should note the end of the season. I should note it's actually not tonight is a really exciting. There's a million games tonight, and a lot of them have playoff implications. We're taping this on Wednesday afternoon. Golden State did us a favor last night by mauling Denver. Poor Denver. Denver must sit there and wonder, like, where is this, like, lazy, unmotivated Warriors team we keep hearing about? Like, where's that? Why do we always get the pissed off, angry Warriors teams that just blow the crap out of us? So Golden State, essentially, barring a real collapse, is locked up number one. So that's over. And that provides a lot of clarity to everyone else, because there was a moment where you thought, I wonder if these teams are going to try and tank to four. Or, like, do they have to hold out the possibility of, like, does Houston actually want to end up four if Denver is one? That's over. Now, the number two seed is now in play for Houston. who has a tiebreaker over Denver. They won the head-to-head series 3-1. I believe all three wins by double digits. They are two games back in the loss column. Denver has a much more difficult schedule, including two straight games, a back-to-back against the Spurs tonight, and then two straight games against Portland, who is also in play. So the two seeds in play, 2-8, are all in play. We know who's in, but and not to say that Oklahoma City can jump to 2 from 8, but like all of those seeds are, you cannot peg a team to a seed quite yet. It's going to be an interesting finish.
I mean, I know we're going to talk about this at some point because we've already kind of discussed some of the topics, but figuring out who's going to get 8, you know, all of a sudden, and we watched it last year, I think, when it was Golden State and San Antonio, and kind of the first round series of the team that all these teams have gotten in by a pretty comfortable margin now. Like you said, the 8 teams have already been figured out, but figuring out who gets 8, and if Oklahoma City ends up in that spot, gives them a huge, enormous test early on for a team that really hasn't played that well the second half of the season, but also as a team that, you know, has the talent to at least take a game or two from Golden State if they're not really on their P's and Q's right away.
Clippers-Houston tonight is now an important game. If the Clippers win that game, their remaining schedule is – if the Clippers win that game – then we come very close to one of San Antonio or Oklahoma City is going to be the 8th seed. Because
right.
The Clippers' remaining schedule is home against the Lakers, who are playing Mo Wagner at power forward next to JaVale, who has had an unbelievable month. But the Lakers aren't good. Then they face the Warriors, who may be in extreme chill mode. And then a potentially big game against the Jazz at the end of the season. This is fun. And so let's start with Oklahoma City, who beat the Lakers last night, and Russ threw up a 20-20-20 game.
That I didn't realize the significance of that until after I kind of read into it. I was like, that's incredible.
It's incredible.
Look, unbelievable.
There's no way. And this is why I am almost certainly going to put Russ on an all NBA team.
Yeah,
despite,
I did last night too.
Despite a historically terrible shooting season, because I don't know what he shot last night. It wasn't good. I got to halftime, and I was like, I don't know if Russ has actually made a basket so far in the game. But he just for a team that just doesn't have guys who can score other than him and PG, he just creates so much stuff. And you just, I've said it before, you just feel that dude on every possession. But they would prefer, assuredly, not to finish 8th. so this is – I feel like they and Boston have been living these parallel existences in each conference where it's just like everyone is just like, I can't figure them out. Like,
right.
I can't figure out what they are. They have these, like, really high highs and extreme and prolonged and puzzling low lows. Oklahoma City does not have does not appear to have any chemistry issues. They appear to get along.
Right.
No one is speaking semi-comprehensibly and semi-gibberish about the burdens of leadership and all of this other stuff.
Wonder who you're talking about.
so let's start with the Thunder. I'll put this to you. Who are you more worried about as a playoff team? Like, leave opponent aside. Obviously, the Thunder are going to have a tougher opponent than Boston.
Right.
Who are you more worried about, like, reaching their ceiling in the playoffs, Boston or Oklahoma City?
It's a little hard to separate those two things, but I would say I'm more concerned about Oklahoma City for one or two reasons. The first is, you know, when you look at the strength of that team, you just mentioned the weakness is that outside of PG and Russ, scoring can be really, really hard to come by. And so with that in mind, you figure...
Do you want me to read you where they rank in shooting?
Oh, no. I've seen it, and I know how bad it is.
At the rim, 19th. Mid-range, 29th.
Yeah.
Threes, 24th. They cannot shoot from anywhere.
And I mean, that's been their problem for forever. And they've, you know, at times they bring in a guy or two to try to address it. It never really moves that much. I still remember my former colleague Kyle Wagner at one point. He is the biggest Russell Westbrook fan of all time. And that year that he won the MVP, Kyle was a staunch supporter, obviously. And he pointed out that not just looking at the stat that you and I often look at, the wide open threes, but he looked at that number and the percentage of wide open threes that the Thunder made relative to everybody else when you took Russ out of that equation. And I think they were at like 28% on wide open threes or 29% on wide open threes. And this is in a year where he's being contrasted with LeBron and other guys that have you know, decent three-point shooters around him. And so he's never had shooting there. But yeah, so the offense obviously is always a little bit of a concern when you've got, you know, grinded out sort of games in the playoffs. But their defense is what's been really concerning to me just after, you know, since the All-Star break or after New Year's maybe. I think they're basically a middle-of-the-road defense, 16th or something like that. That's concerning to me against anybody, but particularly if you do end up against Golden State. And so that's kind of my real concern with them is just you can't really turn it on, turn it off against a team like that. And that's also not the opponent that you want to get if your defense is kind of here and there and struggling from time to time. So I'm more concerned about them. You know, if they get Denver, you know, I think as a Thunder fan, that's who you would want, obviously. If you're picking, I think they'd probably prefer to play them as opposed to Houston, you know, for, you know, not having to guard Harden. But so I've got concerns with them more so than Boston. And again, it's hard to separate the opponent.
Who they're going to play, yeah.
But I think Boston has played poorly for long stretches. They've got all sorts of stuff floating around, you know, at the top with regards to Kyrie and whether he wants to be there after the season, which I think, you know, I think it's very fair to argue that that's kind of been a factor in a lot of this too. But they also have had an X factor who, you know, in years past has been a big enough player to where I don't even think you call him an X factor, but Horford has so many guys' numbers in the playoffs and, you know, is just such a good, person who kind of can neutralize a lot of things in the playoffs as far as the problems he causes other bigs in the East. And so I like some elements of that. I like the fact that defensively I have fewer questions about them. And the fact that, you know, they're I think certainly going to get Indiana in the first round, who if you had to take your pick of upper echelon or kind of, you know, upper tier Eastern Conference teams, that's the team that everybody would want to play. Another team that struggles to score, which, you know, Boston's got the season series so far. It's 2-1. I think they've got one more game this Friday against them. But I mean, you know, I think if Boston can win that series and wins that series in 4 or 5 games, which I don't know if they'll do that, that maybe builds some confidence. And I don't know if they need it, but it would give them some confidence. And if they kind of steamroll a team in the first round, we know what they're capable of. I don't know that they'll do it. It's really weird to think that this team last year was one game away from the finals without Hayward and without Irving, and all of a sudden now we're wondering whether they can do that now. But they seem capable in a way that, you know, Golden State immediately could kind of snuff out whatever Oklahoma City is capable of in the first round.
People, this show is sponsored, as it often is, by SeatGeek. The ticket industry hasn't changed that much in a long time. There's a bunch of big companies who have been around forever, but they don't really care about making the experience easier for you, the customer. SeatGeek is there to change all that. It has 50,000, actually more than 50,000, five-star reviews in the App Store, and it's focused on making your experience easy. It pulls in millions of tickets from all over the web. It's one-stop shopping. You don't have to click around to a million sites out of fear that you've missed a really good deal. It rates each deal on a scale of 1 to 10. It has an interactive seat map. It has green dots for good deals, red dots for less good deals. It's very simple. Every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with confidence. It is by far the easiest way I've found to shop for tickets. Whenever I have a friend from out of town, I need to buy him a ticket to a game. I go there. They've helped me with Broadway shows, comedy shows, you name it. Everything, they have it. Best of all, my listeners get $10 off their first SeatGeek purchase. All you have to do, go to download the SeatGeek app. Enter promo code LOWE, L-O-W-E, my last name, the name of this podcast. Bam, $10 off your first SeatGeek purchase. Remember, that's promo code LOWE, L-O-W-E, for $10 off your first SeatGeek purchase.
Oklahoma City started the season, what were they, 0-4 to start the
season?
Yeah,
it's really slow because Russ was out at the very beginning.
And then he came back, and they just looked so thin. Like, it's just like, man, they have no margin for error and no shooting.
Mm-hmm.
And then they went up and down and back up, and they are a ferociously competitive team. For a while, they were the best. A long while, they were the best defensive team in the league. Right. They have an identity. They know who they are. They're just a huge pain in the ass to play. And now we've gone all the way to the end of the season. It feels like 10 years later. I mean, literally, sometimes it feels like years later. I was looking at...
Think about that PG run where he was the best player in the league for a couple weeks there, and... You know, how far removed we are from that. Obviously, injury questions about him, too. But that feels like it was a really long time ago. And the honest argument that people were making that this was a three-person MVP race for a while, and that seems like it was a long time ago, too.
The reason it feels everything feels so long ago is because of the MVP race. I'm looking at all these stats between Harden and Giannis. And I just a few days ago was looking at Houston's on-off stats to see, you know, how much better they are with Harden on the floor, blah, blah, blah. And they come up in alphabetical order, every player on the Rockets, and the first one is Anthony, Carmelo. I'm like, my God, that was this season?
Yeah.
Anyway, so Oklahoma City has this and now we get to the end and you watch them play, even the Lakers last night, and you're just like, man, they're thin again. It's like we're back exactly where we started, and that's saying even saying that Jeremy Grant has had a better year than a lot of people anticipated shooting the ball. But they just, like, Russ will get in the lane and on a pick and roll, and they'll have done something right where the defense should be on the back foot. They've opened a crease. The defense is at a disadvantage, and you'll freeze it, and you'll be like, it doesn't even matter because the other three defenders are not guarding anybody.
They don't move.
And everyone's in the paint, and you can't get anywhere. And then you look at, like, Ferguson has fallen off a little bit. There was about a month where Ferguson looked like, oh, he just might be the guy. Abrines, we don't really know what happened. He's gone. Robertson never came back. Markieff Morris has been absolutely abominably terrible in Oklahoma City.
I thought he would be a great fit. I mean, it's a small window, but I thought he'd be so good for
terrible. Yeah. Patterson is not playing. Noel has been okay in limited minutes, but Billy Donovan does not trust him. And there's been a lot of quick hooks because he's just, for all the good he does, he's out of scheme all the time. You know, last night they had a play where Lance was sort of meandering, doing Lancey things with PG on him and got like 12 feet from the rim maybe, and was going up for like a leaning floater with Paul George draped, a potential defense player of the year, draped all over him. And Noel comes off of JaVale McGee at the rim and like leaps for no reason.
Yeah.
And Lance is like, oh, you didn't do that. I'm just going to give the ball to JaVale and he's going to dunk.
An IQ
and
thing.
Then
yeah.
like, that's why Billy takes him out. Mm-hmm. And you're just like, man, their margin for error is nothing. Like if Russ has a bad shooting game against a good team, they cannot win. Like, unless it's a 20-20-20 kind of game, they just cannot win, even if Paul George plays well. The supporting cast has not carried the weight.
I'm telling you, though. I mean, I guess it's not as monumental as it would have been when you consider, and even last year. I mean, I guess they lost in the first round last year to Utah. But thinking about how big a swing that is from, you know, two-time defending world champions to playing a Denver team where all of a sudden you look at it and it's just kind of top-flight talent. I find that fascinating, and maybe that's something that we should do at 538 because of the type of site we are. You know, how frequently does a team with the highest talent ceiling win a series, particularly in the first round? And I would venture to guess more often than not it happens. Every now and then you get a situation where it doesn't. I think last year you look back at the Celtics series against the Bucks, and, you know, and Giannis in particular, and that series looked like it was going to be a blowout. Then all of a sudden you look and, you know, they take it to a seventh game. But it's really hard to overcome that. I'm really interested to see not just the talent discrepancy between some of the teams, but Denver being in the playoffs for the first time with a young team.
Well, there's widespread Denver skepticism, which
absolutely.
I get. And I love Jokic. I think that's a very good team. I'm not like, I wouldn't call myself a skeptic. Like, I think they're going to be a good playoff team. I will probably pick them to win a round.
Regardless of who they've got?
Probably. We'll see.
Okay.
We'll see. But my reasons for skepticism are not the playoff inexperience a little bit.
Okay.
Jokic defensively in the wrong matchup is going to be a problem. Like, Warriors obviously are a problem. James Harden picking on him 100 times a game is a problem.
Because you can't.
Just nothing you can do.
Yeah,
you can't hide
him
anywhere.
Out.
Whoever, you can put him on PJ Tucker and PJ Tucker screens for, it's not going to be fun for him.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that has, I think, gone under the radar, is Will Barton and Gary Harris have just not had enough time to get going. Like, they just haven't been the same guys. Now, that lineup, which everyone is waiting all year to see, has now accumulated 400 minutes, their starting lineup, and is very, very good.
It's
very good. It's like plus nine or something per 100. But those two guys are really important parts of their team, and I just haven't felt for anything like more than three games in a row that they look like what
we thought they would look like this year. And Denver is going to need – they are a collective team. They need everybody to play well. Their bench, which has been so huge for them, is going to be a little less valuable in the playoffs when benches are generally less valuable. You know, Mike Malone's already going to a nine-man rotation. And, you know, Jokic is a stud. He's a star. And there will be games where he asserts himself and scores 35. Like, that's going to be a thing. But he is a passer by nature, and he's going to need those other guys to finish plays. And I don't know if they're – we'll see. I mean, that Barton and Harris are the guys I'm watching most closely on that team down the stretch of the season.
Their defense, that was, you know, when you think about the period of time where they jumped out to the best record, I feel like there's one team every year that we don't expect. I remember even back when I covered the Knicks, they did that one year where I think they started 6-0, and it catches everybody by surprise. Denver was that team this year, and generally speaking, it always stems from a team being better defensively than anyone ever imagined. And Denver, out of the gate, was really, really good defensively. You know, they basically stopped dropping Jokic as far back as they were. And the previous seasons, they basically wanted to challenge him a little bit to kind of come up and touch the ball handler off the screen and roll. And, you know, I think there have been other things that have been really surprising. Monte Morris has been fantastic. I think a lot of us, I remember I kept saying this early on in the season, he's playing way, way, way too well to even really introduce Isaiah, I think, even though I think everybody in the league feels bad for that guy. You know, the season that we kind of figured he would have. You come off of a surgery like that, it's going to take you a while. It's hard to come into a playoff situation, a playoff team scenario. But, you know, it's they're going to have a lot of guys get tested. I don't know. Maybe the experience thing is something that I'm more skeptical of. You know, and in fairness to them, it's a little different. But you look at a team even like the Bucks, who haven't won a playoff round. Obviously, they're going to be massive expectations
see,
on them.
People are making that equivalency between Denver and Milwaukee.
There's a big difference.
And
there.
I don't see
There's
it
a big difference there.
Milwaukee's been in, and they've actually performed well against heavy favorites.
Right.
Toronto a couple of seasons ago, mm-hmm. and Boston, taking Boston to seven, was the kind of outcome in retrospect that was like, oh, that's actually better than we thought. Giannis has been a monster.
Yep.
And Middleton last season was like Jordan for seven games. So their best players have something.
And they have experience together, which
by the
think
way,
is important.
Their team is awesome. Did you see Daryl Morey's tweet last night?
What did he say? I didn't see it.
He tweeted back at David Locke. David Locke tweeted something about something. I don't know, something about the All-NBA and Donovan Mitchell. And about essentially saying, shouldn't Donovan Mitchell get extra credit for doing this in the Western Conference versus Kemba and Beal and all these guys who are on losing teams in the Eastern Conference? And Daryl replied with a basketball reference data dive list showing that the Bucks have – by whatever, I don't know if it's just straight record of opponents or some adjusted for home away and adjusted for quality of some fancy math maybe involved, have the easiest schedule in the NBA of the last 6 years or so since 2013, have the worst strength of schedule. And you look at it, they got Philly only three times and they got Boston, I think, only three times. So they got two of the other four good East teams, the minimum amount of times instead of four.
Right.
And I sneakily replied to Daryl via direct message. I noticed you didn't sort that list for margin of victory.
Yeah, where
the Bucks have the fifth best margin of victory behind three of the current Warriors, three iterations of the Steph Warriors.
And the 95-96 Bulls.
No, and because it didn't go back that far. It went only to 2013.
Oh.
His list.
Oh,
Daryl's list.
Oh, I see.
The other one was the 2015-16 Spurs.
I mean.
And so.
Did you see the stat the other day? The only teams in, I want to say, recent modern league history who have 45 wins of 10 or more, and it was six or seven NBA champions, and then this year's Bucks.
Now
every team on the list had won a title, so they're real. I don't care.
Well, the East remains a trash fire.
Absolutely,
and everyone got carried away. Oh, the East, the top of the East is good. Okay, so Philly's good. Toronto's really good. By the way, Toronto, more than any of these teams in the East, looks right now like a team, weirdly, because their key players have missed so many games,
right.
And Kawhi gets to play whenever he wants to, or not play whenever he doesn't want to. They look like a team that's coming together and figuring it out and figuring out their style and their identity and all that. And Boston's good but not great, and Indiana's good but not without Oladipo. They're middling.
Right.
The rest of the conference,
yeah,
is a disaster.
Yeah.
And everyone's anyway.
But I mean, but
I don't even know what my point was.
But Milwaukee, your point was that Milwaukee, whether or not we should view them as dominant because of their competition, I think is where you're going. But to me,
well,
it'd
Darryl
be different
was,
if they weren't dominating teams in the West too.
Darryl doesn't care, but Darryl was very
argument.
Much about the MVP,
right?
And who should win the MVP?
You. I hear you.
Basketball season is in full swing. Playoffs are coming up soon. This is when things start to get very interesting. The contenders start to outperform everybody else. And whenever you're driving your family or friends this basketball season, you should make sure your car has the right tires to get you there safely. Duh, you need good tires. Goodyear knows that performance is everything, whether it's on the road or on the basketball court. So when it comes to choosing tires, let Goodyear.com help you choose what's best. Goodyear, more driven. Boston. A week ago, I looked at the standings, and by the way, I was so wrong about Boston.
I had them in the finals, and I had them beating. I have them beating.
Look, they
Golden
could still
State
make the
preseason.
Finals. They could still make the finals. Well, okay. That's going
to
be wrong.
It's going to be wrong. But I had that as my preseason favorite, just to be cute.
I thought they were going to win 60 games.
Okay.
I came very close to predicting they would finish with the best record in the league, and then when I saw them play in preseason, I said something.
Who did you pick for that?
I don't know if I made a best record in the league prediction
okay.
in the end. And I looked at the standings a week ago, and they were 44-31.
Yeah.
44-31. Clippers at that moment were 45-30. And I something about seeing those numbers, I just had this moment where I was like, maybe the Celtics just aren't very good. Mm-hmm. Maybe this is just – like it's Parcells, right, who said like at some point you just are what your record are.
Yeah.
We're 75 games into the season. You're 44-31. You have a worse record than the Clippers,
yep.
who literally just sort of reached around the league and created a team of random dudes
right.
who are well coached and play hard and play in a better conference, and they have a better record than you?
Yeah.
Why should I take you seriously anymore? And so I came very close. I got on the boat going across the Rubicon, and like I got almost all the way to the end. I was like about to go out on Boston. I'm sitting on the boat. I anchored the boat. And I've got some food.
Let it become a Titanic situation.
It's just a little raft. I've anchored the boat. I have some food. I'm going to sit there close to the banks of the other side of the Rubicon because I'm very close to being out. If Oladipo were healthy.
That's what I'm saying.
100% I would pick the Pacers to win that series.
I picked the Pacers to win last year against Cleveland. And so I felt kind of silly thinking that. And not beating the drum about it. And then it got to a point where they basically were ready to do it and they just couldn't finish the job.
LeBron had cramps. The opening was right there.
It was right there. Do you remember the game? Now we're really getting off. We always get off track whenever I podcast with you. Or whenever you have me on your podcast. Do you remember the game where Oladipo had two quick fouls and McMillan pulled Oladipo?
Oh, it was the latest. It was a Twitter firestorm.
He sat him like forever. And then I want to say he got a quick third and then he sat him for a long time. And it was like, what's the risk here? And just playing him. You got to get back in the game. And then they lost by like two. And so I don't know. They could have won that series last year. I feel really confident if Oladipo were there and healthy and they were closer to like an average offense.
My hot take, which is not a take yet because I don't think I'm going to go all the way there. I think the Pacers have a chance to win that series anyway.
Do you?
Yeah.
I mean, if
that's how – remember, I'm sitting on the banks of the other side of the Rubicon. I'm almost there.
Yeah.
And
the Celtics have been so bad when Horford's not out there.
It's been bad when Horford's not out there. But, okay, so I'm going
to
pull back. Before the season
– to the boat.
Before the season
different?
When I was going
to
make that best team in the league
right.
prediction – I had a lot of smart people around the league. You know, I poll everybody. I call all my friends. Hey, who is interesting to you? Who do you think is going to be better or worse okay. and blah, blah, blah. And a lot of them said, you're too high on Boston. You're too high on Boston. And here's why. You're Hayward, it's going to be a year. Don't assume linear improvement for Tatum. And all these chemistry issues are going to come to roost. And all of that has been proven right.
100%.
So I think you can leave the chemistry drama aside. The flat earth debate, leave it all aside. Okay. I think what I was wrong about with Boston was I just don't think their talent is as good right now as I thought it was before the season. Like Tatum did not have a linear improvement. He's been a little worse this year. Hayward has not been good. Rozier is just not good. And And Jaylen Brown's up and down, and I think he, more than even Rozier, has had the hardest time sort of trying to find his place. And you have games where he comes off the bench like a house of fire and he plays 30 minutes, and then you have games where he misses some shots and plays 22 minutes and doesn't really impact the game. I just think top to bottom, their talent has not been as good as I thought it was. But, and here's where I'm still sitting on the banks. When Horford plays well, they are really good.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the stats, Horford has been bad on back-to-backs and really good elsewhere. And there are no back-to-backs in the playoffs.
That's interesting.
And now they're playing around with Baines. And their numbers with Baines and Horford are outstanding. Now, there will come a time in the playoffs where they can't play them together because of spacing. But maybe they have found something with those two guys working together. They're plus 25 per 100 possessions going into tonight. I believe they play the Heat tonight. They keep pulling me back in when I'm about to go all the way out. But I just think they are right now for me. And you see, like, they don't fear Milwaukee. If they get that
and
matchup.
That's the thing.
They have a guy that can guard Giannis, and they have a bunch of wings that can switch on all the shooting. They are not afraid of that matchup.
And I feel like that Bucks matchup, which I guess would be round two. Again, with the importance of Horford, you've got a team defensively who, when they're at their most comfortable, is going to sit back in the paint and kind of force you to prove that you're able to shoot, meaning Lopez, that play, you know, kind of a defensive format where they would be most comfortable, at their most comfortable, kind of sitting in the paint and not play you in open space. And so we'll see. I'm not completely out on them, but you're right. I think there is a realization. I think my team this year, like that, and for a lot of us who I don't think people were paying attention to the standings. We do our the power rankings every week, me and like four other people at ESPN, and I was always amazed at how low I would rank the Lakers in our power rankings from week to week. And I was just kind of thinking to myself, man, people are giving LeBron so much credit and the Lakers so much credit for LeBron, and not realizing that as he's sitting out, they're going to miss the playoffs because of how much time he's missed. And it took a long time for that to kind of set in for people. And then they had that horrible stretch where LeBron was back, and they basically played themselves out of the playoffs in like a week, you know, where they went from, even in our projections at 538, from like a 25 or 30% chance of making the playoffs to like 2% in the span of like a week and a half, maybe 2 weeks max, because they just kept dropping all these games to really beatable teams. And so I think it always takes a long time for someone to kind of come to a realization that, like, this team just probably isn't capable of this anymore. With Boston, I'm reluctant to get there as quickly because of exactly what we just said. They were just a game away from it a year ago with less collective talent than what they have
now.
And
they were the toughest team in the league last year. They were the mentally toughest team in the league. And this year, they have been the opposite. They have been, if you hit them, if they face adversity,
and that's
they snipe and go at each other, and they don't have the wherewithal.
And that's why that Pacers series becomes interesting, because if the Pacers play them evenly and they get to a sixth game in that series, how do they respond to that based on what you're saying, where they're going to be heavily favored?
The Pacers are the opposite, and this is what amazes me about the Pacers and the Clippers. Two other sort of similar teams, I guess, although I'm not, that's a little
I
bit
think
of a
so, that they lose a star in the middle of the season, they lose a scoring star in the middle of a season, and then have to figure out a way to play through it.
They're similar to me in that, they play really hard.
Yeah.
There's a total cohesion where you never hear anybody complain about shots,
right,
roll, minutes, nothing.
Yeah.
And yet, a disproportionate amount of the players on both teams are free agents this summer, which usually in the cliche of the NBA is a recipe for disharmony.
Right.
And for some reason, those teams have been able to, like, particularly the Clippers, like the Pacers are not going to sign Kawhi Leonard or Kevin Durant. It's just not going to happen.
Right.
The Clippers have had their owner give interviews about how they want to pitch all these free agents, which if you're on the team, you're like, well, okay. It's like, like, I guess it's like Harrison Barnes. It's like, I guess
it's open season
because you all don't want me on the team anymore.
Right.
But and yet it hasn't affected them at all. Like it's very interesting.
Yeah. No, I told you. you and I had messaged earlier in the week about potentially setting this up, and or last week, and both were interested in writing about the Clippers. I'd been around them a week or so ago for something separate that I was working on with Doc. And then you said, oh, well, I'm writing about them too. And I was like, well, you know, that makes me feel small. And let me maybe focus on something different. But you know, I basically said, well, since I kind of did some Clipper stuff anyway, maybe blend something into a story comparing the two teams, because I kind of feel like there's some similarities there too. Not only with regards to record and stuff like that, but I'm really interested in teams that kind of have to shift course mid-season. And so obviously the Pacers had that moment with Oladipo, and I'm kind of fascinated by the fact, and this is probably, I think, the best argument for Doc as far as coach of the year. Not only guys that lose a star player or a star scorer is probably a better way to put it mid-season, but you know, Doc now has had that for two seasons in a row. Between Blake and now obviously with Tobias Harris, and having to reshuffle everything kind of on the fly, have to change some things around on the fly. And the fact that it not only the challenge of doing that X's and O's wise, but doing it with your locker room too, to where guys can accept their roles. Guys can then accept maybe somebody else coming in from off the street who has, you know, a higher up on the depth chart or moves people around, having to share the ball even more. Particularly with guys that are going to be free agents. And so I find those two teams fascinating. I find the coach of the year debate fascinating for like four different reasons, because I kind of feel like it's one of those things where you can't even really passionately argue for someone and detract from somebody else without sounding as if you're almost hating on somebody, because there's so many good people and candidates for it this year. But I think historically, I think it's an interesting year for coach of the year, but also in the vein of what I was just talking about with guys that have had to kind of coach completely teams that were completely made over midseason.
It's interesting because Quinn Snyder, I voted for Quinn Snyder last year.
Mm-hmm.
I believe he came second. He will get no votes this year, and the Jazz will finish with more wins than they did last year, just because just the expectations, right? Like, Bud is the most tailor-made coach of the year candidate because they exceeded expectations. Even for those of us who are high on the Bucks, we did not expect this. And he's a first year coach. You can very easily see he changed X, Y, and Z. Whereas like
right.
Nate McMillan suffers from sort of like, well, we said all these things we're saying about the Pacers. We said it last year too.
That's the problem. And that, I mean, I'll be really honest with you. I don't think anyone will do this for different reasons, but it's also interesting that, someone like, so Mike D'Antoni, you know, obviously won the award. And, you know, very good arguments to be made for them. They were the one seed. They, you know, his trust in James Harden.
He won 2 years ago. He didn't win last year. Dwayne Casey won last year and then was fired.
You're right. But here's the
fired
thing.
Fired and then tweeted a nice farewell when he won by the Raptors.
Congrats, coach. Forgot about that. So awkward. But, you know, the idea that Mike, think about where the Rockets were at a certain point. They were literally in last place 2 weeks into the season. What did they start? 11-14. And, you know, dealt with signings that I thought, you know, and certain people being taken off the roster, not re-signed, that, you know, if money weren't an issue, you would look at it and say, what are you doing? A lot of us had that question. I think we did a podcast either early in the season or before the season started saying like, none of this stuff really makes sense from, you know, just like the best roster standpoint, regardless of kind of whatever Tillman Fertitta's logic is, or if he's trying to save money, whatever it is. And knew it was going to be an experiment going in. It wasn't working. And now all of a sudden they've still got a shot at the two seed. Now I think most people can step back and look at it and say James Harden, that makes him really deserving of MVP or at least very close to that. But it is interesting that like, you know, kind of being okay with giving D'Antoni coach of the year for completely trusting James Harden and then looking at a year where they haven't had their best players there available for the whole season. He's not going to get any consideration. I'm not saying that he should, but it is interesting that like something that is relevant 1 year after someone's won the award isn't relevant again.
Well, longevity, the coaches with longevity are at an artificial disadvantage for
right.
all of these reasons. Like,
right.
And so another guy who's literally, I haven't even heard his name mentioned, is Terry Stotts. And the Blazers are humiliated in the playoffs last year.
Right.
Would have been very easy for them.
I thought they weren't going to make the playoffs this year. I said that on record. Yeah.
Would have been easy for them to fall apart as
yeah.
a team. They're going to win 50 games. McCollum's been hurt for a couple weeks now. Nurkic is obviously horrifically out for the season. And an
right.
injury, by the way, that is so reminiscent of Wes Matthews in terms of
yeah.
the timing
what, and what it means to the
and
team.
This team sort of feeling like it, now I think that Blazers team was better than this one, but the teams is sort of was beginning to enter a period of like, oh, we're something is happening here where we're better than the sum of our parts. We're better right. than we should be. And
that was just brutal injury.
It's gone.
But no, you're right with regards to him and kind of where he ranks. I haven't heard his name either. I think the coach of the year stuff is fascinating. What I would say, Budenholzer this year reminds me a whole lot of someone that didn't win the award the year that he came in and kind of, you know, because a lot of people, I think one of the arguments that some people use, I don't really know that anyone's used it as a mark against Budenholzer, but the idea that when you're replacing someone that had a scheme that was horrible for a team and then you just kind of come in with something that's competent, that you don't deserve credit for it. I mean, Steve Kerr came in right behind Mark Jackson and, you know, kind of overhauled a whole lot of things. He didn't win Coach of the Year in a year where even some of the metrics we were talking about with regards to the Bucks and all of a sudden the way that they kind of scale really similarly to teams that have won a championship where 45 wins of 10 points or more, and all those teams winning championships. Kerr, that first Warriors team with Kerr had so many metrics that look exactly like the ones
who won Coach of the Year that year.
Budenholzer with
the
Hawks.
Oh, that's the 60
win
Hawks. I voted for Bud. I should know.
Which that's to say that, you know, it's not to say he didn't deserve it, but it is interesting that Kerr didn't win that year. He did win the next year for a 73 win team. But, you know.
When he coached half the season.
Right. And so my point is that a lot of times I feel like this stuff is kind of a year late. I feel like sometimes it's kind of like someone's deserving and didn't get it before. And it's very clear they changed the culture of the team. And I think that with this, I also feel like what makes it difficult with the Bucks this year is that they have a legitimate argument for coach, player, or MVP of the year, and then obviously executive of the year. I think they have fair arguments in all of those things.
They do.
And because of it, it makes it harder to really discern if one of them deserves, let's say, MVP. Does that make it tougher to argue then for Bud? Does that make it harder to argue for executive of the year when, you know, they obviously brought in some new guys, and they've been impactful, Lopez, obviously. But does that make it harder, you know, I don't know. I just kind of feel like certain them being in play for all of them maybe makes it tougher for one argument or the other.
Yeah, sure.
So that's interesting. I think for the coach of the year thing, I keep wanting really hard to kind of push for McMillan because I think maybe one of the most fascinating stats from the Pacers this year, and something I wrote about earlier this week, 0-7 last year without Oladipo. Mm-hmm. They were horrible last year. They couldn't win anything without him. This year, not only were 7-4 during the stretch that he was out, before, I think in November and December, but for the season, even after having struggled the last few weeks, are 21-21 with him out. I mean, I picked them preseason to finish a top three seed. I think they easily would have done that if Oladipo had stayed healthy. They obviously still have a chance at the four. What I struggle with McMillan, and struggled with this last year too, is it's really hard to identify kind of what he's done scheme-wise that seems so brilliant that someone else wouldn't have done. I look at guys that are really gritty. I look at a bunch of guys that, you know, that are kind of looking to have a bigger role and want to be kind of trusted with a bigger role with somebody out, particularly this year. I feel like he deserves more credit for the fact that Tyreke Evans has been horrible this year. I didn't realize how dire it was. I pulled it up in my story. Of the 85 players that have taken 200 shots at the rim this year, he is the only one shooting under 50%. And he's shooting under 50% by like 5 percentage points.
Yeah, he's been...
I think he's been hurt too, or at least kind of nicked
hurt.
Up.
I think he's been unhappy.
But it just like seems like a bad fit. And I thought that was a great signing for them. In part because, you know, you didn't want to over-rely on Oladipo for the fact that, you know, if he gets hurt or something like that. But
well, also the way that Cleveland trapped Oladipo the entire series.
Oh, yeah, they just, because there were no other threats.
Yeah, he didn't, you know, they didn't trust anyone else to kind of handle the ball.
So I feel like there are arguments to be made from that regard, but I've really struggled. I remember I wrote a piece last year about how the Pacers were kind of bucking all these trends by taking so many mid-range shots. But in some ways, like, if that's your idea, that doesn't strike me as coaching genius. I know it's worked well enough for the Pacers, where they're a good enough mid-range and a really good three-point shooting team. They just don't take many of them. But the fact that you lean into so many of those things, it kind of makes me wonder, what are you doing scheme-wise that gives you an advantage over everybody else? And if I can't point to something, I feel like it becomes harder for me to argue really vigorously on your behalf. And so I think that's one of the things I really have struggled with over the last 2 years with that idea with McMillan, because clearly in terms of overperforming expectations, particularly with Oladipo out, it seems like he's deserving of at least real consideration there.
Yeah, to me, it's going to come down to Bud and Doc Rivers. I think what the Clippers have done is extraordinary.
Yeah.
Given the turnover, given that they're starting two rookies and Ivica Zubac at center.
The third guy that's in there all the time, yeah.
And, you know, Zubac isn't a rookie, but he may as well be for sort of the perception of him. And they're sixth in the West. I mean, sniffing at five.
Could be higher than that, yeah.
It's pretty.
And the trade midseason.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there's a nice enough narrative there. It's funny. We have a 5-on-5 coming out soon at ESPN, where we were asked to kind of rank order the different things we consider with MVP. I think you could just as easily say it for the other awards too. How much do you consider narrative? How much should it matter? And I don't place a whole lot of importance on it, but I think a lot of other people do. I do think it's interesting too that, like, now as Doc has had, you know, the duties of president taken away from him, you know, does it give him a new ability to lock in on things? And it's interesting because you talk to people around the team there and some people feel differently. Some people feel like Doc, you know, even early in the season was still leaning really heavily on his vets. That's what Doc has kind of always done and has always gone out and signed guys.
Most coaches do that.
No, I mean, it's not specific to him.
If Pau Gasol had not gotten hurt, DJ Wilson wouldn't be playing right now.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's actually kind of good for the Bucks that Pau Gasol got hurt.
That was the one thing I never was quite understanding about the Spurs situation too, is like, I get that he could put up points and rebounds, but that's no different than what he was doing with the Bulls, really, where you still know that there are elements of your game that are being hurt by him getting so many minutes. But yeah, with Doc, I think he came in kind of preaching in the preseason even about the idea of playing Avery Bradley next to Patrick Beverley and how they were going to potentially be the best defensive backcourt in the league, and Bradley just wasn't playing well. And the idea that, you know, Doc had been through so much with Avery Bradley, even dating back to Boston. You remember he actually benched Ray Allen over that, and that was one of the kind of the undoings of that situation out there, because I want to say they had the best five-man net rating in the league with Bradley, but not with.
Yeah.
So I mean, there were, you know, some roots there, obviously, but Doc obviously is going to kind of trust what he knows and what he's seen from guys over time, but that can kind of make you more resistant to being open-minded to young guys who can help you and who can do things differently. And so early on, I think there was some of that, and I think there were some things that kind of happened because they were forced to happen because of different things that the front office wanted to see or was doing. And then obviously the trade for Zubac, which, you know, I still can't believe that happened.
Well, our Dave McMenamin reported that the Lakers just called. We're like, hey, you want to do this trade? Which, okay. Not a feather in the Lakers cap.
No, there haven't been many from a front office standpoint.
The Lakers, it's just rotten in Denmark. It's just their culture is rotten.
Yeah.
I can't quite get into it all the way yet, but it's just, it's internally their culture is broken. It's broken. And I'm not sure the new coach is going to fix it. I don't know what's going
to
fix it.
I mean,
not sure that a trade is going to fix it. The culture is broken. And
star free agent may fix it.
They need, maybe.
But do you feel like they need a better culture to draw the star
that's
free
it.
Agent?
We're not talking about the Lakers anymore. That's it. We're moving on.
All right.
The Lakers stink.
Let's move on.
Listeners, hiring, I can imagine, is one of those things that can be challenging and time consuming. There are hundreds of job boards. Do you have to post your ad on every one? How do you know that you're not missing the one job board that has the right person? But there's one place where you can go that makes it simple, fast, and smart, and that place is ZipRecruiter.com/lowpost, the name of this podcast. ZipRecruiter sends your job automatically to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, and they don't even stop there. They have powerful matching technology that scans thousands of resumes and proactively
finds people with the right experience and then double proactively invites them to apply to your job. You've done nothing except use ZipRecruiter. Bam, they've found people for you. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 80% of employers, that's a lot. If you shoot 80% from the foul line, that's pretty good. 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. You pretty much can't do any better than that. Right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free, zero, nothing, at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/lowpost. The name of this podcast, LOWEPOST, that's ZipRecruiter.com/lowpost. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. So that brings me to, I'm going to give you three awards dilemmas that are currently troubling me, and you're going to help me, okay?
All right, I'll try.
I'm taking, by the way, I mean, we're not talking MVP. I'm taking MVP to the wire. It's the first year I've ever done this.
That's my opinion, too, because I feel like every time I want to say something, Harden has another 50-point triple-double.
So. Well, and last night he had 30-whatever on 15 shots. The guy's ridiculous. I'm taking it to the wire. I should be a Giannis voter. My track record suggests I would be a Giannis voter because I care about defense probably X percent more than the average voter. And Giannis is...
And they're going to have the best record. I mean, there's all sorts of things. Narrative, I feel like, would normally be on his side. At this point, Harden won it last year. You know,
I am taking it to the wire.
You should with how close it is.
But we're not going to talk about that.
Okay.
Let's start with the rookies because we were just talking around Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. First team all-rookie, to me, has four no-brainers. Luka and Trey. DeAndre Ayton, look, you can give me all the arguments about empty stats and bad defense and all that. The guy, the numbers are the numbers. The guy's having on a terrible team. He's one of the five best rookies in the league this year. That's three. Jaren Jackson Jr., despite, I think, 58 games played, is going on my first team. He was qualitatively the third best, or you could argue he was the second best rookie. And it's not close. So that's four. That leaves me one spot for one of the three following guys. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. Why can I not say his name? Alexander.
Because it's a difficult name to say.
SGA.
Someone called him SGA at a scrum I was at, and Doc was like, oh, we're on like an initials basis now. I believe
the PA announcer says that sometimes during Clippers games.
It's easier to say.
SGA, Marvin Bagley, or Colin Sexton. And as Brian Windhorst wrote today, the Cavs are going on a... It's not quite Tyreek Evans 25-5 as a rookie, but they really want Colin Sexton to get
first. I got an email from them and I don't vote. So I very clearly see that they're pushing for him and they should. I mean, any PR department should, whether it's silly or not.
All right, so who should I put out of those three?
I would take Shai. I mean, I think Sexton, I just wrote about him last week. I wrote a whole story about just him. Actually went to Cleveland to do it. I just think he had too slow of a start. I mean, he has been great lately offensively. No matter what he does defensively, at least this first year. I mean, the Cavs are literally going to finish with the worst defense statistically in modern history.
Yep.
Colin is a massive part of that. As much as I like him, you pull him off the floor and they basically become a slightly worse than league average defense immediately. And so that's a big part of... Again, if we're going to consider defense, and you and me in particular probably consider it more than the average person, you have to factor that in. But also the fact that he's been lights out shooting the ball lately. He was good. I mean, he's been a good three-point shooter all year, but he was so inefficient early in the year, in part because of where he was shooting the ball from. You know, we were 2-3 weeks into the season when his own teammates were anonymously talking to Joe Vardon, saying that they didn't think the guy could play. And so... I just think when you're having that slow of a start, not granted, you know, for the worst team in the league and, you know, in a small market where, you know, they were left for dead after LeBron left, Kevin Love wasn't there. That's all totally understandable, but he was so bad those first few months that I can't really, I think he deserves to be all rookie. I don't think first team is like a definitive you had to be.
There will be analytics, more analytics minded than me voters who will leave him off second team.
Which I he also played every game.
He will make one of my all rookie.
He played every game in a year where a lot of even the rookies didn't. I think his availability was useful or not, depending on how you feel about defense and stuff like that. But he's played so well offensively for the last month and a half, 2 months that I think leaving him off entirely. The other thing that he struggles with that he has to get a lot better at is his vision. I think he actually may end up being more of a two guard over time. He has the lowest assist rate of any point guard, at least over the last 30 years. of anyone that's had a usage rate of 25% or higher. I think he's only got a 15% assist percentage.
Yeah, passing would be helpful. It is interesting because I've been talking to some of, I've run into the Cavs a few times in the last month or so. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it is making them think, you know, we're going to have some high draft picks coming up. Like, what kinds of players?
Maybe a point guard.
Do we not have a regular point guard? How does that factor into who we should draft with these picks?
Morant would be interesting, but they would really struggle on defense if they go that route because they'd be so small in the backcourt. But I get the impression early on that he may be more of a two.
I'm leaning towards SGA.
I think I would go with Shea there because when you and I talked, who was the other person you were considering? Bagley.
Bagley's good.
Bagley is a good player, and I would have no problem with someone going first.
This is the best all rookie since I've been voting, which is not very long. But this is the one where I get to the second team, and I'm not like, ugh, this is a reach for 9 and 10.
Right.
It's like I kind of feel bad leaving like 11, 12, and 13.
Because by the time you get to that fifth first teamer, you're kind of like, you don't even feel great.
Clearly,
about
I've
that
just
person.
Told you who two of them are: yeah. Sexton and whoever doesn't get it out of Shea and Bagley. Mitchell Robinson has to be on it.
Yeah, I
has
would
to be on
too.
It. There will be people who put him on the first team.
Yeah.
I can't get there just because of the minutes and how sort of late he came to the party.
Yeah.
But he has been qualitatively per minute. One of the five best rookies in the league.
I have
amazing that Kevin Knox is the Knicks' third best rookie this season.
Who
Alonzo Trier?
So I'll say this too: the Sexton idea I wrote about recently was Neil Payne, my coworker at 5:30, very smart, brilliant, had noticed that Sexton up until 4 weeks ago was having literally the worst box plus minus in modern history season, and so. I was initially going to kind of write, how can that be the case when he's shooting as well as he's shooting? Which tells you how bad his defense and his passing and those other things were. But that was when you prorated it with a certain amount of minutes. When you took that prorated part off and just looked at it just straight up, Knox was ranking worse than Sexton was. So, I mean, a rough year. Yes, he was hurt. Yes, he was playing with that Knicks team. But there are just some rough edges there that, you know, The Knicks' development over the last 10 years or so, probably farther back than that, probably go back to 20 years, has been rough with rookies. But he's going to have some stuff to work out in the second year. And it'll be interesting to see how much of an opportunity he gets with that.
That's not me being low on Knox, because Knox has struggled in a way that exactly the ways I would expect a 19-year-old rookie wing to struggle. He's bad defensively. He takes some difficult shots, and he just trying to understand what the hell is happening. Like, I'm not worried about Kevin.
There were some signs in summer league, like pretty simple things that even Fizdale was pointing out, like where he would kind of take off a step too early with regards to trying to go toward the rim for a shot. Just certain stuff that can be fixed and stuff that you can kind of grow out of, but
yeah,
it's gonna be a while, but that's fine.
I'm not worried about him. I'm worried about Frank Ntilikina and David Fizdale being like, well, he's on our roster, isn't he?
Will he be on the roster next year? But it'll also be interesting to see what happens with them in free agency, because I'm always fascinated by teams that have to speed up the clock really fast when they get someone that they weren't expecting to. You remember David Blatt and Cleveland and the situation, the track they were on, even hiring Blatt in the first place, and then all of a sudden LeBron falls into their lap, and then it's like, oh, and frankly, with Luke Walton, you know, the idea that when you get someone that you didn't know you were going to in free agency, all your rookies, unless you're looking to trade them away for something bigger, kind of become afterthoughts as far as you'd like to involve them, but if you're trying to win right then, Ntilikina and Knox are going to be guys that probably get less minutes because of it. But anyway,
It's a good all-rookie class.
Yeah.
Bottom line. Listeners, do yourself a favor and check out this week's Russillo Show podcast. Friend of the program, Ryan Russillo, chats with Will Cain about a bunch of cool stuff. I love going on Russillo's show. I love when he comes on my show, and this episode should be a good one to listen to as well. Check it out. Award dilemma number two. Third team All-NBA center. Now, this is assuming you have Jokic and Embiid in whatever order you prefer as your first and second team All-NBA centers. I penciled in Karl Anthony Towns because I just think offensively he's so monstrously special.
Yeah.
And defensively, the Timberwolves have been a complete train wreck. When I watch the Timberwolves, or more accurately, what is left of the Timberwolves, I don't think Karl-Anthony Towns is good defensively, but he does not strike me as the problem defensively. And if you actually look at his shot contest numbers on our fancy second spectrum tool and even the rim protection numbers on NBA.com, right, he's not bad. He doesn't come off as bad. And they're way better when he plays because he's an offensive centerpiece. Obviously, Gobert is a different kind of offensive centerpiece.
Yeah. That team runs as many screens as anybody.
And defensively, he is a system unto himself. He's an architecture unto himself.
Right.
And interestingly, if you look at the Utah's numbers when Mitchell plays without Gobert, their offense drops to 93 points per 100 possessions, which is like,
wow,
15 or 12 points worse than the worst offense in the league. Now, it drops the other way, too. When Gobert plays without Mitchell, it's similarly bad. Mm-hmm. So there's clearly a symbiosis there between their two best players, which is good. That's a tough one. Adding to the toughness of this whole dilemma, which I thought was just going to be Cat versus Rudy. Now, if you polled 100 coaches in the league, based on my polling of a smaller number than that, 80% of them will say Gobert because they just, well, whosever team is winning, you have to take the guy whose team is good.
I feel like people in the league would always be more likely to do that too.
And there is something to the fact that, like, Cat put up, he had that month where he was just scoring 40 and 35 every night in games that didn't matter. Like, they just didn't, winning or losing the game was immaterial to the team.
Right.
They were, like, vaguely in the playoff race, like, extremely vaguely.
Can I ask you this? And it'll be a really quick departure. Does Gobert being left off the All-Star team, does that matter to you at all? And the idea of like a makeup or something that if you feel like it should have happened and it didn't?
No.
Okay. That's fair.
No. Different rosters, different, you know, Gobert I had on my Western Conference All-Star team. I had both Gobert and Towns on my 12-man right. Western Conference roster. This is a 15-man NBA-wide roster where centers, tough luck, get three of the 15 spots.
Sure, I hear.
Now, complicating this, the league has made Karl Anthony Towns eligible at forward and center on its official Ernst & Young approved ballot, which now, I've got five forwards that are in.
Okay.
Giannis, PG, Durant, Kawhi, and LeBron. And LeBron deserves to make it. I don't want to hear about how LaMarcus Aldridge might make it over. No, stop. Just sit back and think about what you've just said. Stop. LeBron is making third team All-NBA at worst. Okay? That's five. One spot left. I have Blake Griffin penciled in. I can put Cat there and get Cat and Gobert on, but boy, does that mean to Blake Griffin.
I don't think I could do that to Blake.
That's mean.
Blake.
So like, literally, when I wrote it down, I had a pang of sadness. Like, a real pang of sadness.
So, can I say this? And this is rough. I feel like even the idea of saying Leonard is automatic. With LeBron, I can make the exception. Because I feel like it's LeBron. The guy put up triple-double numbers in all these games the Lakers were losing. I mean, it was LeBron. Kawhi, and you hinted at this earlier. You didn't come, you weren't saying it in like a negative way, but Kawhi playing kind of when he wants to, you know, and the idea that it's been load management for him. You know, he is coming off of a weird injury from last year. He's a free agent. You're also not going to push him.
He's only going to, LeBron, I believe, has played how many games?
50, was it 58 or something like that? Like, Kawhi's only going to finish with like one or two or three more.
Well, LeBron only played 55.
55,
and
okay.
Kawhi.
Maybe Kawhi was at 58.
56 now.
So, you kind of get where I'm going with that. Like, Kawhi defensively, too, is putting in more than almost anybody. And so I would get the argument, but I guess what I would say is that with Blake, as we're talking about these different things, it didn't dawn on me until I was writing something Pistons related. Blake just missed, and this is Blake, someone that has had injuries for the longest now. Blake missed his first game due to injury, I want to say Sunday or last Saturday. He had missed three or four games before that all season, and they'd all been rest. It wasn't anything health related. The Pistons, generally speaking, had fallen off a cliff offensively when he's not there, in part because losing someone is, you know, you would normally think as insignificant as Ish Smith. Not having a second ball handler in that lineup, particularly when they're missing Blake, is death for that team because they don't have a whole lot of options. Drummond is not an ideal offensive option. He can do some things, but
he's been outstanding. By the way, he's not as good as Gobert and Cat.
I mean, you could have made an argument if you had four all NBA teams. You could
he merits a. Let me just look up his numbers for a few minutes.
I noticed that last night as we were. I remember you sent me an email kind of saying these are the things I want to talk about. I at least looked at it and kind of gave it a second look. Like he has numbers that are better than you expect.
As does Vucevic, by the way.
Vucevic has been good too.
As would have Nurkic. Nurkic was very quietly having an outstanding
season. He was having some historic
games. He was their second best player this year, with apologies to CJ.
Absolutely. I would have a really tough time though leaving Blake off, in part because he's been so healthy and because he's been the linchpin to what they're doing. They're going to make the playoffs. Second time in 10 years they'll make the playoffs. Blake has been, I mean, he's been their best three-point shooter. It's a lot of stuff where you just kind of take him out and they crumble. And I kind of feel like maybe I lean more toward the league types when you're talking about playoffs and non-playoffs. When there's one player and a team is kind of comprised of mostly just one player and you take that piece out and then they just crumble offensively, and they've been healthy all year, I tend to think that I would go in that direction first before I would with someone who – You know, I know Kawhi's been great this year when he's played, but they've also been really good without him. And I think that's a lot of credit to Siakam, which I know we both love that guy.
My thing with all NBA is all NBA, particularly third team. I'm going to look up my ballot from last year just to make sure I'm remembering it correctly. is all NBA for me is if you read, like I had Curry on third team last year.
And he had played. He had missed a lot of time, too.
He played 51 games.
Okay.
I had Chris Paul on my third team last year, and he played, let me look it up.
He had missed a lot of time as well.
I just feel like if you hit 50 to 55, Chris Paul last year played 58.
At that point,
you're just clearly one of the best guys.
Right.
And now LeBron is the exception to this part of it. Curry and CP were on the two best teams.
Right.
Kawhi is on one of the X best teams. LeBron is not. So that, and Dan Devine wrote about this yesterday about how rare it is for, it's not rare for a guy to make all NBA playing 50 to 60 games, particularly third team. First team's a huge honor. Second team's a big honor. Third team is just kind of like, who are we kidding? It's the LeBron LaMarcus thing. Like, who are we? It's like one guy's LeBron James, one guy's LaMarcus.
Yeah.
Like, who are we kidding? Steph Curry is like, what are we going to have an all NBA team without Steph Curry? He's like, Steph Curry. Now, LeBron's on a bad team, but they weren't bad when he played until he came back from injury and they were bad.
Sure.
And he's just like, he put up 28-8-8. Like, it's LeBron James putting up LeBron James numbers. It's like,
I make the exception there. I guess if it's LeBron doing that, you know, as they're getting eliminated, he's still, LeBron's defense was like horrific at times this year where there was no effort, but even then, you know, the idea that he's basically putting up triple doubles as they're getting eliminated or as they're eliminated, like that says something to me. When I have to draw the line between that and his like totally legitimate injury that he was missing time because of, and between that and the idea of someone who has historically always been injured and is playing 20 more games, is getting his team into the playoffs because of it. I could see the argument for Blake there, and in particular him versus Towns. At least I would probably use that last spot on your ballot for Blake. But I mean, there's an argument to be made either way. I also think it's interesting that the league is allowing Towns to be voted in potentially as a forward because I don't really think of him as one.
No, defensively he is now when he plays with Taj Gibson, which was the starting lineup for the bulk of the season. There are a lot of opponents who will defend Cat with their fours because Cat's got 3-point range and Taj Gibson does not.
Who, by the way, is shooting 40% from three this year.
I keep saying this. People,
Towns has been.
Towns has the potential to be the most versatile scoring big man in NBA history.
He's
period.
Good.
End of story.
Yeah.
And so from that sense, okay, he's, I guess, treated as a four in some vague way, but defensively, he's always guarding fives.
Right.
And offensively, even when Taj Gibson is playing, he plays more like a five. He's posting up a lot. He's their primary pick and roll. I last year I believe I put LaMarcus Aldridge as a forward. I did. I put him as a second team forward because the forward, due to injuries and randomness, forward was like bare last year. It was impossible to fill out forwards that you felt comfortable with. That's not the case this year.
Right.
And I felt icky about that because he was mostly a center by the end of the year.
Mm-hmm.
this one would make me feel like I were stretching the boundaries of appropriateness, even though the NBA has said to us, it is appropriate. Go ahead and do it.
Right. Do you feel like it should always be positional as far as the spots or?
No, we should eliminate them.
Yeah. I just kind of feel like when you have a positionless NBA.
Yeah, I would just pick the 15 best guys.
Because at this point, when you've got guys and something like that changes your argument, like what position is the NBA considering someone at? I feel like it'd be an easier exercise or an exercise we could feel better about. But anyway.
Well, this will all be over in a week, and then the real games will start. And then after the real games start, the real games start on July 1st. Because, you know, in terms of like what fans actually care about, it goes free agency. And what really matters in terms of who wins the championship, free agency.
Absolutely.
And then draft, and then actual basketball games in the playoffs, and then like actual basketball games, which are kind of like events, I guess, that exist on Twitter and, you know, all that.
Hell, Summer League exists on Twitter. It's like a massive deal. The Big Three matters to people on Twitter somehow.
Chris Herring writes for 538. He has a piece up right now about the Pacers. Last week about Colin Sexton. His work is always wonderful. You should read him. Chris, thank you for coming into the studio.
Thanks, man, for always having me. I appreciate you.
The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Drive always discovers possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.